All right, all right, all right. Got Justin, Jenny, Prey, Nicholas, Javier.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Hey, Justin. Doing great. How are you, man?
Great. Doing well. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for jumping on.
Of course.
And we got Jose as well. I believe. Did I just boot him out? Oh, boy. Oh, yeah, there he is. Jose, by default, you may be on mute, so you just have to click that button to speak in. For just about everyone, this is the first time using Telegram Voices. Telegram released Voices a few months ago, and then they upgraded it to Voices 2.0. And I think it's largely this movement to audio first and almost looking at video as a bug, not a feature, with the rise of Clubhouse and some other social media startups. Jose, are we connected? I know Justin is, right?
Yes, I'm here.
All right.
Yeah, it's a new experience for me too. It's first time on this. It seems like a pretty clean interface though.
Yeah, have you used Clubhouse before?
I actually have not. I know all about it, but I have not personally used it.
Yeah, I'll have to invite you. It's a pretty unique social experience. It is refreshing, actually, I find, to not have video. It's like there's a few different apps that came out and actually raised a ton of money doing what you call it, like spontaneous video group chat. House Party was a big one, and there was a few others. Yep. And the video aspect, it actually degrades the conversation, I find, because people tend to fixate on what's physically around them as opposed to the meat of the conversation. So
it's true.
Yeah. You know, it's like if we were doing video right now, I'd probably say, oh, what's that picture in the background? And we maybe, you know, just kind of distracted by that almost in a sense where it's there's something nice by just doing a phone call or in this case, just doing a, you know, video chat.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're not only distracted by the, you know, what's around the other participants and their videos, but also yourself making sure, you know, in today's world, when you're fully remote, making sure you combed your hair this morning.
Check, check, 1, 2.
There he is, Jose.
All right, I think I'm in, hey, yes. Jose. All right, sorry, audio issues here.
All good. Well, let me just do a quick introduction here. So people are going to be tuning in, dropping out, and then we have about 620 people in this group. So we'll be recording this, and then we will pull it down and then show it on social media and other places too. But last time we did this was last Friday we did this, and it went extremely well. We had at one point about 35 people in and about a total of 100 people that tuned in live. So it was pretty fun. It was a unique experience. We were just saying similar to Clubhouse in a way where it's audio first. But I wanted to invite you guys in to get your different perspectives. The show will last about 25 minutes. So we'll say by 2:30 EST, 3:30, everyone's in different time zones. I feel like the 3:30 Buenos Aires time, you guys are on Pacific. I think you're both on Pacific Coast. I know Jose, I think, is in California. And then Justin, where are you in the world?
I'm East Coast right now, over in Connecticut.
Oh, you are? Okay. And Jose, are you still in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I'm out in Los Angeles.
Nice. Well, let's see. So mostly the people listening will be developers, people that are in South America primarily, although other people are in the U.S. We had a few questions that I wanted to just kick us off. I'll point this to Jose to kick this off. One popular question we got was, what technologies are, when we think about software technologies, they're obviously changing. It's probably the fastest changing part of technology in general when you consider, you know, the mechanical world, the hardware world. Web-based has to be like the fastest, and then on that, the front-end frameworks. What technologies do you see now being the most in demand from either clients you've worked with or just developer forums? Not anything particularly niche, but a technology that has a real unique advantage and is being deployed, and there just aren't quite enough people, or maybe just speak freely about just web technology trends in general, whatever comes to mind. I'd be curious to hear.
Yeah, I definitely come from this at a perspective from the Laravel PHP community, because that's what I'm ingrained in. But even with that, one thing that I do see kind of really, really taking off is technology that can be used for both the web-based and mobile, things like React Native, languages like Flutter, like Google's coming out with Flutter now, things that can be easily deployed to both Android and iOS with the same code base. I think that's really, really hot right now. That's one of the things that we are seeing a lot of from the agency side of things, of our clients just being like, we would really like to have this. Like, can we get something like this integrated? Of course, the web-based thing is still pretty hot. Laravel there's a lot of work for Laravel developers. We are at Titan still like hiring people in, because we have so much work coming in that we need to cover. But on top of that, the native, the mobile development that can be kind of pushed out to both, to iOS and Android at the same time is pretty trending right now.
And Jose, I should have started with this, but do you mind just giving a quick background as to how best you would describe your expertise and interests?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Jose Soto, currently lead programmer at Titan. We are a web development agency that specializes in Laravel, Vue, and React. I have a strong history in the startup scene in Los Angeles. Previously, I worked at tech startups like Media Temple, Verb, Home Hero, Harvey. I've worked in all types of code bases up and down the stack. In fact, I do like DevOps, sysadmin, back and front end mobile. I cast a pretty wide net. But I love to educate and share knowledge and build up community and network along the way. In fact, my online handle is Jose Can Help, and it's exactly what I like to do. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
That's awesome. And Justin, do you mind doing the same? How would you describe your interests and direction expertise?
Yeah, sure thing. So compared to Jose, I'm a bit more in the hardware space. So mechanical engineering background. Currently, I'm an operations program manager at Apple based out of Cupertino. So work on consumer electronics, more hardware electronics focused. In the past, I've been in the semiconductor industry with ASML. I think there's a lot of cool progress in there. But that's on a high level, my background.
Yeah, and I knew Justin. We went to the same college, University of Connecticut. One thing I think both of you guys do extremely well, and which is very unique, is you both are very technical and then also are fantastic communicators and networkers as well. Just community builders is probably the more accurate way to describe it. So I think that's something that when we talk about what developers can do to maximize their long-term career probability of success, I think both being a very good communicator and engaging in the community, as well as being sharp in your craft, are just two equally important things. You can't just be great and hide under a rock. You have to be engaged in some community, and it could be Reddit, it could be Twitter, it could be just a personal network, Telegram. But I just look to you guys for examples of how developing a good relationship with people is just like hugely useful. Justin, absolutely. I'm curious from your perspective, so you got a job at Apple. You're only a few years out of school, out of college. How was that experience for you? Was there some lessons you'd learn or advice you would give to your younger self when you go through this process? People listening, I'm sure, are going to be thinking about, how can I work for a company like Apple or Google or something like that? Curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure thing. And thank you. I've been at Apple for about six months right now, and it feels like it's only been a little bit. But I've, like you said, only out of college for a few years. I think upon graduation, I didn't land a large tech job out in the Bay Area. But what I did land was a tech company, an up and growing tech company that would provide good experience for a large tech company. So having a chance to work in the semiconductor field with ASML, working with silicon chips and pretty high-tech engineering designs, it really gave me the skills that I felt equipped me for a larger tech company in the Bay Area. So having the background from that previous job and constantly keeping an eye open for opportunities is really what led me to Apple, where I am today. Some good tips that helped me out along the way, making sure you just, I think you said it very well, making sure you maintain a list of contacts and people in the fields you're interested in entering, at the companies you're interested in entering. If you speak with a recruiter or a team member and, you know, maybe they're not interested at that time for bringing your skills on board, it doesn't mean no forever. So make sure you stay in contact with them, make sure you catch up with them and see how they're doing every now and then.
And did you get the job at Apple through a recruiter, or was it directly applying?
Yeah, good question. So it seems like Apple is currently poaching ASML quite a bit, just from seeing the number of recruits going between the company. And I had a recruiter reach out to me while I was working at ASML. And although that first encounter didn't lead to an offer, it just led to initial conversation. It led to that initial connection. And when I followed up roughly a year later, just giving an update on how I've developed my skills further at my existing company, and hyper target those skills towards a job opening at Apple that I felt would really align with what I've been doing. That's when it really, went to the second round interview, third round, fourth round, and then an offer.
Mm-hmm. So it was four rounds, four, I assume, half hour, hour long conversations.
Yeah, it was like a half an hour, screen. And then if I recall correctly, another half an hour with the team that I'd be working with. The third one was actually quite long. That was a full day interview, including a presentation to the team. So that's the more challenging one. And that was for a technical operations focused position. So it might be different for a hard software focused role. Mm-hmm. And then the last round was just a director level half an hour phone call.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah. I want to bounce back to Jose, kind of just playing ping pong here for a second. One other question that we got in the poll was how international developers can be successful with US startups. Obviously, with COVID now, we're a year into it. And I've seen just anecdotally so many tech companies go remote. And I have to imagine, over half of them or some significant percentage of them will stay remote that were previously in person before. Have you seen a lot of folks from other countries kind of all, now when you look at your dev teams, are they, like the United Nations, different flags? And or do you really see, how do you sort of see that split? Do you see teams becoming extremely international or like a slow creep? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the clients that I end up working with already have their kind of in-house teams, so they haven't pulled in like international. And when I say international, I mean international from my clients, because our clients themselves are international as well. So like they usually have their developers from within the same country that they're in. But I do see that international workers are being picked up by United States-based startups. And when I have seen this happen, there are a few things that, like a pattern almost, that you see before that happens, is that the international worker has done a few things. They've already begun their networking process, right? Twitter is accessible to anyone, right? You can have a Twitter account and you can participate in a community very, very inexpensively. And that is something that they do incredibly well. So they have either a Twitter account or a Telegram account, depending on where the community is kind of has a stronghold. They participate in the network, show by example. There's so many international developers that I've seen really play a big part in open source technologies. you know, anyone can contribute to these things. So they do it. They do it on their free time. And by doing that, they not only showcase their skills, but they showcase that they're willing to participate in the community. And that goes a really long way when people who make the hiring decisions look at these developers and they say, like, you know, how much have they participated in our community? And so that's kind of the pattern I've seen: participation, networking, and showing by example. Another one it's not as important, but it does make a big difference is, you know, English competency. It matters quite a bit for these companies, because the communication needs to be fluid. But you know, there I have seen in many cases that kind of gets pushed off to the side as far as importance goes, because the real grit is, can this person do what they say they're going to do? And by showing that you can participate in network and actually produce good quality code, like that goes a really, really long way.
Yeah. On the open source side, how is that typically tracked? Is that through commits on GitHub, or is there just how would you demonstrate that?
It's difficult because it's like a startup. Let's not even say startup. If we just talk about company, because I'm coming at this from like what Titan sees. When we see a developer participate in an open source project that we do not own, but we see them working in it, that's one way of doing it. Another one is, we have open source projects that we own, so then when developers commit to our project, we can see their code. And another one is, like, if there's just talk on Twitter of like, oh, hey, I got this PR from, you know, such and such developer. It was fantastic. Like, there's talk in between the community of someone participating in that project. So it's not even like us, Titan, needs to be involved directly in that, in the code itself. But if we see that there's someone out there that's actively participating in the community, that piques our interest, right? The flags kind of go up, and we keep an eye on these developers, so that, you know, when the time comes and if we do have an opening and they start to apply, their name is familiar to us. And we understand, we know who they are, and we know that they've been active in the community. And then we can go back and look into their GitHub history and see the code commits, and, you know, and then of course the code samples that they send in.
I'm curious too about the English proficiency. So it seems like, because the internet was invented in America through the DARPA program, the code is pretty much, as far as I know, every major web technology is written with an English backbone to it. You know, all the, you know, just about every method and function has English as its derivative. Is English effectively a monopoly on software at this point? And then, you know, everyone else just has to get on board. Is that how things are trending?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think of it in like terms of even language that explains, you know, something like RESTful APIs, you know, the verbiage that goes into explaining them, developing them, you know, it's very English based. And so, yeah, I do feel, and it's unfortunate that it's this way. Like, I feel like we, as Americans, we are very, coddled in this sense, you know, like we only need to know English. And I'm like working with a client that's like in Germany, and they have, you know, all of these German speaking developers that's their like main language, but then they're like doing entire presentations in English and code in English. And like, these people are just phenomenal. So yeah, anyways, side note, but yeah, I do feel like we kind of have a stronghold on the language of how to develop. But it's always, you know, something that's kind of in the back of my mind when I start up my own projects. It's always like, you know, the language differences is something that if you want your project to become, you know, internationally used project or product, to keep that in mind. But
For most people that we've worked with at Otter, it is, I'd say 85% are quite fluent, and then there are probably, you know, another 15% that struggle with English, but they may be really good developers. So I want to ask, like, this is maybe a question for both of you guys, but on the tech side, say putting aside language specifically, where is the best place for people to learn? Like, if you're kind of, say you're out of college, maybe you didn't get a degree in computer science, and you're, you know, wanting to make a transition, or maybe you're a hobbyist, or even if you did get a CS degree, and you want to just sharpen your skills on web tech, have you used any of the tools out there? Are there any, where are we at in terms of the state of the industry for accreditation in particular, things that are recognized, like Coursera, I know, Udemy, Khan Academy, YouTube videos. Is it just the Wild West on credentialing now, or have you guys seen any specific places where there's more regimented credentialing for software?
Justin, you want to take this one? I can hop in afterwards.
In terms of that question, Mike, are you focused more on learning the software skills or the language skills?
I guess both. I mean, you should mention too, Justin, you've organized large hackathons with hundreds of people. And I think that's a fantastic way to learn to work with people as well. But yeah, however you see it, I think more about the software skills in particular.
Yeah, like you alluded to, you know, if there's any kind of hackathons or similar events going on in your area, or in today's world, I actually just was involved in a fully remote hackathon about 3 weeks ago. I was helping out the running a workshop during that. So if you can find a hackathon, which is full digital, all online, or if, you know, you're lucky enough to have one in your area, that's a great way to practice your software skills and work on a team that, if you choose the right event, will predominantly speak English. And a lot of times, especially if you're, you know, in a multicultural hackathon, you have, you know, different skills on a team. And if maybe your English isn't the best, your software skills aren't the best, you can work with others who can help supplement those to build a product or build an idea that could, you know, build your brand, reach your build out your connections, meet more people along the way as well.
Before you jump in, Jose, I just want to introduce one more person who's our special guest. Quentin Ruiz is, Quentin, can you hear us?
No way. Are you able to speak? Yeah, I can hear you. It's good to see
you. Yeah. Yeah. So Jose and Quentin know each other. We all worked together previously at Home Hero. And Quentin is passionate about education, in particular, the ability to learn and integrate with the internet online. He's worked at a couple projects on that. But welcome to the conversation, Quentin.
Yeah, glad to be able to join all of you. Thank you for inviting me.
So Quentin, where do you see the state of the, we'll call it, for online education, for people that want to level up their skills, maybe in software specifically or in other areas? And then just, if you wouldn't mind, give a quick introduction as to your interests and expertise.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can give a brief background about myself first before I jump into the question. So I've kind of been on an interesting learning journey, especially in the past 3 years, and specifically with coding. I only did a little bit of computer science when I was in college and realized that no matter what I wanted to build going forward, that knowing computer science and knowing how to code was going to be a very critical skill no matter which direction I went on afterwards in life. So I've honestly done the gambit, everything from Udemy courses to doing a coding bootcamp for 60 hours a week while I was in San Francisco for 3 months, to even at one point saying I went to Thailand for a little bit and I ran a coding bootcamp fully online for about 30 or so college students to learn the very basics of JavaScript full stack with HTML and CSS. And even now, I mean, I'm still in the education space doing a different form of interactive online learning. But I think one of the biggest things that I learned throughout all of this, especially on the computer science side for learning, is it really depends on the type of person that you are and what your learning style is, because even certain things like on Udemy, you can get full stack web developer boot camps in JavaScript for $20 to $50. And honestly, that content is not much different than when I spend $10,000 learning going to a coding boot camp in San Francisco. So it's kind of the idea that if you have the willpower, if you have the motivation to be able to learn these skill sets for yourself, it's very doable to be able to self-teach yourself from anywhere, given you learn the right skill sets, you learn the right things for where you want to go in your life. But having said that, I think one of the biggest things that's kind of been missing in computer science curriculum is, as I'm sure everyone on this call knows, computer science curriculum gets outdated within 2 years. And a lot of times people think, I'm going to go to school to learn how to code, when sometimes they're learning languages that are built in the 80s or 90s. And even though it's nice to be able to learn how certain things work and you're giving the mindset so you can learn languages quickly, which again is a critical skill set, I think that oftentimes we associate the prestige with a college or university as opposed to saying, can I actually apply these skill sets that are relevant and important for me in terms of what you want to build or where do you want to go in your life? So if I had to answer the question directly about kind of what's the quote unquote best places to learn how to do something like computer science as a hard skill, I think there's honestly quite a few good ones out there that you can do it for very cheap. You can do it effectively, but more than anything, make sure you have someone to help keep you motivated and accountable while you do it. So if you were, say, to do a Udemy course on web bootcamps as an example, have someone there that's going to be with you grinding through it at the same time. Because if you don't, there's a reason why online courses only have a 3% completion rate at the end of the day, if that. And for those that have 90, 98% completion rates, having other people there really is a big factor. So I'm happy to go in more detail on the nuance of that question, but I hope that gives kind of a broad overview of the way I think about learning computer science as an example.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really interesting. I really like especially the point about the community and the accountability portion. I want to introduce our double special guest. Jacob Peters is joining us now from New York. Jacob is the founder and community manager, I guess. Jacob, I don't know how you would describe your specific position, but you are the founder of Launch House, which is a really cool company that is a community of founders and creators can build together. Jacob, how's it going?
Thanks, Mike. I'm not in New York currently. I'm actually out in LA. But Launch House is still in the early days. Quinn, who you all just heard from, actually was one of our early members and champions when we were building this down in Mexico. But we've since moved things out to Los Angeles. We basically bring in 25 founders, engineers, entrepreneurs, and creators every single month to live in this big house together and create awesome products. And I'm one of the co-founders. Our CEO also handle all of our community management. So at this stage, when the team is only six people, I kind of get to do all of the above. But one of the core theses around, you know, the reason in which we're building this company, this organization, and it's not even really a company. You can think of it more as like an institution, you know, akin to like a Y Combinator or a Harvard University that we plan to have last for hundreds of years. And one of our core theses is that actually that this, the concept of like education and learning is actually getting unbundled from the educational institution itself. So if you think about what you know, an educational institution represents, it's pretty much three things. It's number one, it's a credential. So there's some sort of filtration process or application process that has to happen in order for you to get accepted to one of these institutions. You know, whether it's something like an Ivy League school, any sort of university, a boot camp, an accelerated program, there's like a certain credential that it has because there's an application process. Number two, it has a community. So it has a group of people that are all going through a shared learning experience with you. And then number three, there's the actual content and learning itself. And our theory is actually that like learning and content that oftentimes happens in a very top-down manner from a lot of traditional institutions is going to get unbundled from that pie. So the reason for this is because you can learn anything on the internet. education and learning is basically just at its most core, basic first principle level, a way to download information into your brain. And I'd argue that the most efficient way to download information in your brain is not the traditional top-down lecture-based format that a lot of educational institutions espouse. It's actually probably just watching YouTube videos. It's reading articles. It's just going deep in internet rabbit holes all by yourself, because there's an unlimited amount of information out there to learn literally anything. I have friends that are surgeons, and like they literally watch YouTube videos before they go into surgery, because like that's how these people learn. So if that's the case, and top-down learning is getting unbundled from the educational institution, what's left? Well, it's credential and community. And learning can actually happen on your own through internet research. But I think learning actually happens the best and the most when you're surrounded by a group of super talented, smart individuals in your domain. And that's exactly what we're doing with LaunchHouse. So we have a high bar to create a valuable credential for people. So we get thousands of applications every single month, and we filter it down to a few dozen people. And then we put these experts in literally the most intimate environment possible, a house with four walls where everyone's eating, sleeping, and breathing and breaking bread together. And they're all just constantly learning and being sponges and soaking up each other's wealth of knowledge in addition to doing their own learning. So this is one of our core beliefs on what educational institutions of the future are going to look like. It's basically going to be a credential in a community, and you're going to do all the learning by networking and talking to other smart people, and then doing your own kind of independent research on the wealth of knowledge that's available on the internet.
That's very cool. And Jacob, do you see this as being something that rolls out across the world? And until it does, it's not useful for people in other countries or other cities outside of where you physically are? Is it local dependent in order to get any value out of the community?
So we're experimenting with both models. We do have ambitions to scale the global, to scale the physical model globally. So you could imagine there'll be a LaunchHouse in every major city and tech hub across the globe. But in the meantime, we're going to be scaling up some of our digital community programs, which scale a lot better over the coming months. So stay tuned and check out our website, launchhouse.co, if you want to learn more.
Cool. Well, I'll leave it open for another 2-3 minutes here. Does anyone, Jose, Jacob, Quentin, do either you guys, Justin, we've got a great group here. Any of you guys want to bring up a last subject? We've talked about education, different web technologies, community building. Justin works at Apple, and he talked about his on-ramp into Apple. Anything you feel like is unsettled and want to kick off with the final few words? Jose, I know you'd mentioned you wanted to touch on education. Is there anything that was left unturned there?
No, I think we covered most everything that I was going to cover. I don't know if any developers here are Laravel specific, but you know, one of the places that I go to really learn a lot is Laracasts. Titan is also developing onramp.dev, which is kind of like an intro to just web development in general, and trying to give kind of resources, curated list of resources for new and upcoming developers. I've learned on egghead.io, teamtreehouse.com, but absolutely one of my favorites is always going to be YouTube. Like, you know, just like Jacob was saying, YouTube has such a wealth of knowledge. I'm constantly in there. I actually have my own channel in there as well. I love to share little hot tips on my Twitter account. So whenever I come across something really fun and cool, I'll share it there. But anything that I can't fit into a tweet, I will put up on YouTube just to share that knowledge there.
Yeah, and that's Jose Can't Help, right? That's your YouTube and Twitter?
Correct.
Nice. And it's funny, Jacob, when he mentioned the surgeon example, my wife is an orthopedic surgeon, and we moved to Boston so she could do a fellowship here. And every morning at 6 a.m., she's on YouTube watching the case that she's going to be doing that day. She does a lot of spine surgery, and like YouTube is her default education platform. So it's incredibly real how accessible education is to anyone in the world with a smartphone. I listened to this really good podcast last couple of days, the Tim Ferriss Show, that had on Bology, and he was talking about the number of people in India who have come online in the last 10 years. It's like 400 million people now are connected to the internet that weren't connected. I think the span was 10 years. It may have even been 8 years, but it's just astronomical. It's like, you know, the United States and a quarter just came online. And the impact of that is just, you know, we're not going to feel that we're not going to realize it for years, but it's just huge. So Jose, you mentioned a few closing remarks. Maybe we'll just go around to Quentin, Jacob, and Justin. Just mention what you'd be looking for, and then how people can reach out to you if they were inspired by your comments and thoughts. Jacob, you want to go?
Yeah, sure thing. Appreciate you teaming up, Mike. And I need to. It's funny that episode that Mike mentioned from the Balaji and Tim Ferriss podcast. He actually sent me that the other day, and it's on my backlog. So I'll probably be listening to it this afternoon. But if you want to learn more about me and what I'm up to, you can find me on Twitter, J_Cub, or you can check out our site at launchhouse.co. We're always looking to meet interesting engineers and entrepreneurial people or builders of all types that are looking to get involved in our ecosystem. And personally, if you want to send me a Twitter DM, I'm more than happy to chat about anything, you know, career-wise, education-wise, capital raising, early stage startup formation, whenever I have the time. So that would be a good next step if you're interested to learn more.
Awesome. Yeah, and I know we have a solid base here of at least a few hundred that'll tune into this and hundreds more that are all in Argentina. So in Buenos Aires in particular, I think would be an awesome, awesome place to think about going when you go international. Quentin, do you want to give a sign out?
Sure. It's just been wonderful to be on. Thank you for inviting me, Mike. If you want to learn more about what I'm doing, you can go to, it's called lectureless.com. So the word lecture, LESS.com. And we're doing interactive online learning experiences. So the next course that we're doing is actually going to be on low code and no code development, because there's all these new things such as Zapier coming out, and you can even build things on Bubble and other platforms where you can even create entire platforms such as Airbnb from scratch without having to write maybe a few lines of code here and there. But for the most part, we're abstracting away more and more levels of what coding actually is. And for us, we're trying to do it in a way that's kind of like what we talked about earlier about accountability, being able to come on at the same time with other people, and to be focused on learning outcomes, not just completing the actual course. So if you want to learn more about what we're doing, lectureless.com. And then if you want to send me a message or have any other questions, I'm probably still a little bit old school when it comes to reaching out in the groups. So if you want to find me on Facebook, Quentin Ruiz, I'm probably the first one that'll show up on your search bar.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Jose, Quentin, Justin, and Peter for jumping in. It's Jacob Peters. It's been awesome. Thanks for everyone listening, and we'll have another show next week. So until then, see you guys later. Mucho gusto.
Later.
Bye.
Take care.